Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than a half million Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. First up today, we have news from Normal. Our news today from Normal's senior policy analyst, Paul Armentano. New Mexico's Governor Richardson helps revive medical marijuana legislation. The New Mexico House of Representatives approved legislation on Tuesday that seeks to establish a statewide medicinal cannabis distribution program. The bill, Senate Bill 523, is a substitute bill that is virtually identical to the Lynn and Aaron Compassionate Use Act, which House members had narrowly rejected last week. As proposed, Senate Bill 523 mandates the State Department of Health by October 1, 2007, to promulgate rules governing the use and distribution of medical cannabis to state-authorized patients. Those rules shall address the creation of state-licensed, quote, cannabis production facilities, close quote, the development of a confidential patient registry, and a state-authorized marijuana distribution system, and, quote, define the amount of cannabis that is necessary to constitute an adequate supply, close quote, for qualified patients. The bill now returns to the Senate for concurrence with a minor House floor amendment. Senators previously approved the measure 32-3. Governor Bill Richardson, who worked closely with the House to persuade members to reconsider the bill, is expected to sign the measure into law. Quote, this bill will provide much-needed relief for New Mexicans suffering from debilitating diseases, while including the proper safeguards to prevent abuse, close quote, Richardson said. He continued, quote, I am pleased that the legislature did the right thing, reconsidered this important bill, and supported a humane option for New Mexicans who endure some of the most painful diseases imaginable, close quote. If approved, New Mexico will become the 12th state to enact medical marijuana legislation since 1996, though it will be only the fourth to do so legislatively. More information on New Mexico's Senate Bill 523 is available in the Take Action section of the Normal website. We have links to get involved at normalaudiostash.com.
. 76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. and over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Because of technical difficulties this week, we're re-airing our December 13th, 2006 discussion with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, dealing with sex and marijuana. It's a great segment, and next week we'll be back with a brand new cannabis science feature with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash, we get the chance to discuss the science of marijuana with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at State University of New York. He's author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Mitch, today we're going to discuss a very juicy topic, sex and marijuana. The ONDCP and DEA would have us believe that smoking marijuana decreases sex drive, yet we hear from Carl Sagan and Ann Dryan that their best sexual experience happened after smoking pot. So let's cut to the chase here. Does smoking marijuana affect your sex drive?
As it turns out, we don't have a lot of data addressing actual desire, and we do have tons and tons of sort of informal clinical reports where people say sex is certainly enhanced during or right after marijuana use, and so it's hard to even entertain the idea that somehow your sex drive would drop with long-term use. Obviously, that's not something that's been a priority among a lot of big funding agencies, so if it does happen, we certainly haven't heard about it.
So when we hear about this anecdotal evidence, are people saying their experience is enhanced or their sex drive is better?
We've got data from as early as the 1980s suggesting that the experience is better. Men report seeing themselves as more giving and that people are generally more sensitive to touch, in part because time is distorted. After smoking marijuana, people at least seem to think they spend a lot more time in the sex act. There's a lot of enhanced orgasm reports, both in Charlie Tart's data from 1971 all the way to like ancient Chinese things in 200 AD. So I think this is a pretty consistent effect and one that folks like to talk about. I do want to caution that cannabis is not a lubricant, and we do see a number of drying of mucous membranes, whether it's in your eye or anywhere else, that could be affected, and that's why I have to recommend that people keep that in mind if they're planning on sexual contact after using cannabis.
So that common cottonmouth effect of smoking marijuana isn't just from having the smoke pass over your palate, but it's drying up the body overall as part of the physical effects of marijuana intoxication.
In fact, all mucous membranes are drier after use, and that would be something to make investment in a lubricant worthwhile.
Mitch, you mentioned this sort of temporal shift when folks are smoking marijuana. Is that sense of spending more time having sex in and of itself enhancing the experience?
As it turns out, we don't have data directly addressing that, but it certainly makes a lot of intuitive sense. I think the other thing that we hear a lot is just there's really nice, candid discussions about what you like and what you don't like after cannabis that often don't occur when you're, either using alcohol or no substances at all. And I think more than anything, it's what are the occasions whenever this happens. So people often don't use cannabis before sex unless they know they're going to have enough time and they're going to be in a comfortable setting and they're in all these other situations that seem to contribute to good sexual performance as well. And so what I recommend to folks is if they want to use cannabis to enhance sex, that's great. But think about what are the other things that you're doing when you do that and see can you do those more often as well. I know parents of young children often find themselves in situations where they're tired and rushed, and what a surprise, it's not as good as things used to be. Well, if they could arrange to, get rest and find an environment where they could be uninterrupted for a longer period, that alone would contribute so much. And then if you want to use cannabis to enhance that further, why, by all means, go ahead.
And Mitch, using the media buzz phrase out there, what about sexual promiscuity? We have a lot of evidence that alcohol increases sexual promiscuity in men and women, but does that happen with cannabis intoxication?
We only have really two published studies suggesting any link between cannabis use and, say, condom use or having unprotected sex or things like that. And I think what happens is there's a subset of folks who are sort of disinhibited in general, sensation seekers, if you will. And so they do report using cannabis and having unsafe sex. We don't have a lot of data showing that it was actually the event when they used cannabis that also led to the unsafe sex. So we don't really know if it's causal so much as just a quality of a certain kind of person. Obviously, you know, with practice, anything like this can help. Does it lead to promiscuity? Well, people who use cannabis also have different attitudes about appropriate numbers of sexual partners, and it's not so much that cannabis leads to these things, but that these are things that correlate. People who enjoy cannabis may also have different ideas about how many sexual partners they should have in their lives or what level of commitment they have to have.
Let's also talk about one of the pop culture legends promoted by the ONDCP, and that is sterility in men. Mitch, can smoking or eating cannabis make a man sterile?
In fact, it's not a complete falsehood. Gabriel Nahas published some data on some men who were living in a hospital and smoked 8 joints a day for 8 days in a row, and their sperm counts did decrease. They didn't go down to the sterility level, and of course, they returned to normal when they were no longer using cannabis. So it's a temporary decrease in sperm count, and I guess, you know, if I had somebody coming to me saying we're having some fertility problems, I would recommend going off for a month or more just to give yourself the chance. But it's nowhere near birth control, and that's the thing that really worries me, is that there may be folks out there thinking that heavy cannabis use would be a good way to prevent conception, and that's just not the case at all.
And what about women? Is there anything that points to marijuana making women less able to conceive?
What's funny is the only data we have are from studies of women who were having fertility problems, and they do have some women in those samples who used cannabis, and they don't show any differences in their ability to conceive, but ironically, they're the ones who had sex more often. So we don't know if it's that they actually do have a lowered probability, but they're having so much sex that that makes up for it, or what. Really, really heavy, absurdly large doses of THC will interrupt estrus, the menstrual cycle, in apes and in certain other primates, but it's the dosages are just so high, it's a ridiculous comparison with humans and normal cannabis consumption.
So there's no way for a woman to smoke a dose of THC high enough to affect conception.
Exactly.
Also, Mitch, let's look at the other side of this. Is it good for our overall sexual health to be intoxicated every time we have sex?
I would not say so. I think the cool thing about sex and relationships is variety, in that sometimes something as simple as, you know, lying on the bed the other way or going into another room of your house can make all this difference. And then making sure that you really get the opportunity to talk about it, to praise your partner for the things you like. And it sometimes can be as simple as, you know, grunting and groaning a little bit more just to make sure that the message gets across what feels good. And suddenly you find you like this person more and you're much more willing to talk about both positive and negative things more. And the bottom line is, yeah, cannabis can enhance that, but, you know, once in a while is great. If you do it every time, of course, then it's not special anymore, and you end up kind of stuck in a rut as far as that goes.
I'm always amazed, Mitch, when we talk about people who smoke cannabis together, that we have better conversations and gain a deeper understanding of our partners and ourselves. It seems that cannabis is this wonderful catalyst for an at-home version of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Well, what's funny about that is we don't have the placebo control, so I think some couples may have the excuse of, oh, I was high, and can always take back anything they said. But in fact, a lot of folks report being able to share, you know, either feelings or stories of incidents that are really meaningful to them during the intoxication experience, either because they have the excuse of saying, oh, well, I was intoxicated, in case their partner has an adverse reaction, but also they just seem more willing to take risks as far as what they're willing to share, and you see that across a whole bunch of different domains. So, yeah, I think that that's a neat little adjunct to couples' cognitions and their sharing.
We also see in the media and in our spam email boxes the incessant push for erectile dysfunction drugs. I'm not sure how much of a widespread problem this is compared to the marketing. Many of these drugs promote blood flow, however. So can cannabis promote blood flow and thus help with erectile dysfunction?
I think the key on this is this weird United States focus on sex having to require a big, hard penis. That's just not the case. What a wonderful thing it would be to say sexual contact doesn't necessarily mean a certain act and only that one. And I think cannabis often loosens people up with their expectations about what sex has to require in order to happen. And then with that pressure off, yeah, maybe you're more likely to have standard erectile functioning under those circumstances, but also be open to the idea that you can have, you know, a lot of hugging and kissing and warm interaction and touching up against each other without the standards clinical definition of erection. The irony, too, is I think cannabis enhances sensation, and that's the source of erection we'd really like there to be, not some artificial trapping of blood in certain areas of the body. Yeah.
So, Mitch, do you think that American men really have this incredible rate of medical problems with their erections, or do we just have a skewed view of the sexual act in this country?
I think it's a little of each. As the baby boomers are aging, we do see also people are more candid about fessing up to having erectile dysfunction. But this American perseveration on erection isn't absolutely required seems to really be there. And as these drugs got developed, I felt like the marketing of that got more and more severe and absurd.
So in the end here, whether we're married or single with one or a variety of sexual partners, we should be seeking out an enhanced experience with sex, not necessarily an enhanced erection. Better communication and sensuality. This may sound like a feminist stance here, but this is something that works for men just as well for women.
In fact, men who, you know, have only one partner and who report a lot of depth in the relationship in general also do report enhanced sexual experiences, where folks who have multiple partners and don't have the same level of connection often in the long term suggest that their sex is not enhanced. In fact, it's no longer as fulfilling and connecting as it could be.
And there's also that BBC report earlier this year showing that married couples actually have more sex over their lifetime than their single counterparts.
And that's a study that my wife reminds me of often.
Mitch, I want to thank you again for joining us here today. This has been a great topic.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at State University of New York. He's author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudio-stash.com. Some fine music found at podshow.com. We have links to all the artists at normalaudio-stash.com. Next up today, some commentary from your humble host and narrator. Thank you. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein, with this commentary today, Wednesday, March 14th. California's medical marijuana held to a higher standard than pharmaceuticals. Since last year, the DEA has specifically targeted for raids California medical marijuana dispensaries that are doing particularly brisk business. 11 West Hollywood dispensaries were raided in a single day, and subsequent raids have happened each month across California. The DEA has publicly stated that they are focusing on clinics that appear to be making a profit. DEA Special Agent in Charge Javier F. Pelna stated to the local press during one of the raids that anyone who uses marijuana proceeds to, quote, buy fancy cars, boost their bank accounts, and exploit vulnerable citizens is not compassionate, they're criminal, close quote. But our healthcare system in the United States is run as a for-profit industry. From the research of new prescriptions to the sale of the next generation of sonograms for expecting parents, every angle of healthcare in America earns someone a buck. Using Agent Pelna's reasoning, the DEA should be making visits to Pfizer, Merck, or one of the many companies raking in billions of dollars in profits treating sick Americans. Specialized care like chemotherapy, even simple surgery, run very high profit margins, and when it comes to prescription medications, those profits can be staggering. Richard Clark, the CEO of Merck, the makers of Vioxx, received a raise in his base salary just this week, from $1.2 million per year up to $1.7 million per year. Clark's base salary is also boosted by frequent cash bonuses. He received a single bonus of $1.8 million this year. And that doesn't even mention his stock options or other financial benefits. Merck also employs armies of researchers, marketing professionals, and drug sales representatives. Those sales reps are essentially pharmaceutical drug dealers who make sure that physicians push their products on the public as well. Merck sales reps earn an average of $200,000 annually and get many corporate perks, including cars. So, who is really exploiting vulnerable citizens in America? Well, the entire American healthcare industry, of course. Corporate drug dealers even get to push their products into the living rooms of America every day via aggressive and often misleading television ads. Folks, it is estimated that by the year 2012, one of every $5 an American citizen earns will be spent on healthcare. Merck, Pfizer, and Bristol-Myers Squibb spend an estimated 30% of their capital on advertising. So, in the year 2012, it could be possible that 30 cents of every dollar every American earns, every one of us, could be spent by drug companies to advertise expensive pharmaceuticals right back to the public. Perhaps most disturbing is that the regulatory process for medication in America has now been fully exploited and corrupted by the well-funded politicking of large drug companies and healthcare providers. This control over the FDA and other regulators by big medicine has only secured those large profits and fueled the outrageous hike in healthcare expenses for the country. And unlike medical marijuana, drugs like FDA-approved Vioxx and others have been shown to have devastating side effects for tens of thousands of individuals. Those side effects can even result in death, something medical marijuana has never caused in a patient. The stories of working-class Americans forsaking even their food for life-sustaining medications are common now. The Medicaid revamp that confused more than assisted, that was the government's solution to exponentially rising costs of pharmaceuticals. Meanwhile, busloads of seniors venture to Canada or Mexico every day, looking to get a reprieve from the sentence of spending their hard-earned retirement simply surviving on their pharmaceutical regimen. Yet no official has cared to question the overall compassion of big medicine in America, and those who benefited from it the most, like Merck CEO Richard Clark. Those made wealthy from the for-profit treatment of the sick and dying citizens of this country are certainly not ashamed of their success. The detriments to society and hypocrisies of senseless marijuana prohibition are many. But to expect that a medication, especially an inexpensive one, that works with few side effects and no risk of death, could be available completely not-for-profit ignores the reality of American healthcare. The citizens of California are at an interesting crossroads right now with medical marijuana. Patient access and the dispensary model have worked to the benefit of tens of thousands who suffer a variety of medical conditions. California could allow the providers of the legitimate medicinal treatment of marijuana to play the well-understood American healthcare game, reaping some of the same financial benefits as those who supply us with the rest of our big-ticket medications and medical care. California could also create a more definitive tax system so that cultivators and dispensary owners could officially report the costs of wholesale medical marijuana. Once those wholesale costs and taxes could be taken into account, officials and the public could understand that these dispensary profits are currently being artificially exaggerated by imperfect taxation and reporting procedures right now. In many ways, the DEA and others seek to hold medical marijuana to a higher standard than the big pharmaceutical companies. If California and federal authorities insist on keeping medical marijuana not for profit, then that same ideal must be used to call for safe and affordable access to all pharmaceuticals for all Americans. If medical marijuana can be non-profit, surely American healthcare can be too. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein.
Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, this is Webb Hubble. Life insurance is now available for responsible marijuana smokers. For years, responsible marijuana smokers have not been able to access affordable life insurance products. They've been forced to lie on applications, forego the health benefits of responsible marijuana use, or purchase life insurance products that did not require an application or a physical. If they were honest about their use of marijuana, they were either flat out declined or rated so high that they could not afford the coverage they needed. No longer. Recently, one of Normal's members contacted them with a problem. He was expanding his business and his bank was requiring additional life insurance. His local insurance agent had told him he simply had to quit smoking marijuana to get the coverage the bank was requiring. He didn't want to quit, and he wanted Normal's help. They contacted me, their insurance agent, and someone who was familiar with the insurance problems marijuana smokers face, and we both wanted to find a solution. I contacted my associate, Marvin Address, a nationwide expert in the area of life insurance, and we took on the challenge. Marvin was finally able to convince a carrier to underwrite the Normal member without the usual negative implications of marijuana use. The member not only received the coverage he needed, he was able to save additional money on the premiums he was paying for the coverage he already had in place. Normal uniquely supports cannabis consumers. As a result of this occurrence, Normal, Marvin, and myself decided that the time was ripe to make traditional insurance products available to responsible smokers without the usual negative implication. Two carriers have already agreed to offer all of their traditional life insurance products at all levels without excluding individuals who smoke marijuana responsibly. I am hopeful that this program can be ultimately expanded to make available disability and health insurance products as well. Help Normal and help yourself. If you've been declined for life insurance, are paying above market premiums, or simply want to know what now may be available in the way of insurance for marijuana smokers, contact me at info@mclaughlinonline.com or simply call me at 202-293-5566. Challenging as it may be, Normal is a public interest organization working hard to both reform cannabis laws as well as providing valuable services to their membership and cannabis consumers all around the world.
Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.